House Committee on Revenue for February 27, 2018 will come to order. Colleagues, thank you so much for being here promptly. We have one bit of testimony on House Bill 4026, so we'll open the work session on that bill and invite former representative and former chair of the committee, Lane Shetterly.
Who?
I had the great pleasure of serving with Lane when he was chair of the committee in 2003. And at that time, I won't go into detail, but at that time, the person he's working with at the Oregon Community Foundation and I formed an unholy alliance against him involving a particular bill.
I remember that.
And it was a lot of fun.
I remember that.
Anyway.
I haven't forgotten.
Can I add to that just very quickly,
please.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. We're going into reminiscence mode.
Yeah. Well,
I apologize.
It's kind of fun. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd share with you, colleagues, while I didn't have an opportunity to share with Mr. Shetterly, Representative Shetterly on Revenue Committee, I did have a chance to serve with him in our caucus. And like the good chair, I think we've been here 9 terms.
Way too many.
Way too many. And I would share with you, get to know Mr. Shetterly. By far, he is in the top 1% of legislators who have served in this building in his statesmanship and his approach to solving problems. And so, Lane, it's great seeing you.
Thank you. It's wonderful.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Vice Chair, thank you so much. And I'm humbled by those comments, but I thank you for them. You're very gracious. It's good to be home.
And for the record.
For the record, yeah. My name is Lane Shetterly. I'm here today wearing my Oregon Community Foundation Board of Directors hat. I sit on the board of Oregon Community Foundation with former Representative Max Williams, with whom Chair Barnhart was aligned against me in that 2003 session. But all bygones are bygones. And just very briefly, for the record, the Oregon Community Foundation is Oregon's largest community foundation. It's one of the largest community foundations in the nation, with almost $2 billion in funds under management. Last year, we awarded $112 million in grants to communities across the state and scholarships. So it's a great organization. And for me, it's a real personal pleasure to be associated again with my former colleague, Max Williams, who is the CEO of the Community Foundation. I appreciate you taking a few minutes to let me just address you briefly on the -3 amendments to House Bill 4026. That's why I'm here today. You have my written testimony. I'll stand on that. Just briefly, the situation that this bill addresses is this. You have someone who has built a life and a business in Oregon, maybe with their family, who at some point makes a decision to, and as part of that life in Oregon, they've established themselves as philanthropists, giving to the Oregon Community Foundation or any number of community foundations in the state, or making a program of charitable giving part of just what they do in support of nonprofit institutions in this state. At some point, they make a decision to relocate out of the state and establish residence and domicile in another state. And there may come a question at some point in time as to whether they have sufficiently severed their ties with Oregon for the purpose of domicile in this other state. And there may come an examination then to see whether they are in fact still subject to Oregon law under our rules of domicile and residency for tax purposes. And the Department of Revenue and the tax court then in that case engage in an application of various factors to determine just where their residency is and specifically whether there's residency still in Oregon. There was a case in the Oregon tax court last year that applied a number of factors looking at things like where the family ties were, where the business activities were, driver's license, voter's registration, vehicle registration, where the doctor care was sought. And one of the things that was examined was where they made their charitable giving. And that was a consideration in terms of whether or not they were still a resident of Oregon and subject to Oregon tax. And so we have a concern that careful advisors and practitioners now will advise their clients if they are intending to relocate out of the state, will advise them to stop their charitable giving in Oregon. If they have established a charitable fund, quit putting money in it. If they have been giving to various community and nonprofit organizations in the state, stop giving that because it may serve as a marker of residency in Oregon. That's a real risk to Oregon charities, and a double whammy if it happens that we lose that charitable giving. We want to encourage that. We don't want to discourage someone who's committed to Oregon and wants to continue supporting Oregon philanthropy. So these amendments in the Dash 3 simply say that that charitable contributions or activities of an individual or the individual's spouse in this state will not be used as evidence of domicile or residency for the purpose of establishing a domicile in Oregon. So it encourages people, even when they leave the state, to continue to be generous and to give to Oregon charitable organizations and to continue to fund the charitable purposes that they have been funding through their lives here in Oregon. I commend it to you, and I thank you for your consideration of the bill.
Thank you very much. Amendment. Thank you. And I think he described pretty well. I neglected to have Chris describe the amendment to us, but I think he described pretty well what the amendment does. It's a gut and stuff. Removes everything that's in the bill now except the clause that refers to when it goes into effect, and it substitutes the language that he referred to. Are there any questions for him? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, not a question for our good former colleague, but for staff and for perhaps you. I feel very, very supportive of the bill before us, but I'm a little nervous about the relating to clause. Are you nervous
Thank
at
you.
All about that, or is there something we should be thinking about with that relating clause?
Let me answer that one, because I think that's a question for me. I agree with you. The relating clause is a big one. You could do all kinds of things with it, and it's wise to be sensitive to it. I will tell you that the chair of the Senate Finance and the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee agrees with Representative Shetterly about the importance of this bill, and has promised that he expects that it will pass his committee without amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we've had that same conversation.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for former Representative Shetterly? Thank you so much for taking the time off your law practice and coming to talk with us.
Great today. To see you.
It is wonderful to see you back in the building, even if only for a minute.
Yeah, thanks very much. Wonderful to be back in hearing room A. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Want to move it?
Yes.
Dash 3.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4026.
Representative Smith moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4026. Discussion? Objections to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Smith?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 4026 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 4026 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. I will carry, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 4026 and open a work session on House Bill 4080. Who's on that one?
Kyle is.
While Kyle's coming, let me just say that this is the large reconnect bill. And we're dealing with a gut and stuff today that has to do with the issue raised for us by Treasurer Reed, having to do with a constitutional problem in Oregon and a new statute in the big tax bill from the federal government. Do you want to describe it further?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. That's precisely correct. House Bill 4080, we do have the Dash 9 amendment, which there's really two parts to it. The first is a smaller part, and it's updating a connection point related to ABLE accounts. And that was more or less just not caught in the underlying reconnect bill. So that's not in Senate Bill 1529, which is the bill that moved out of the Senate committee that has all those individual reconnect points. So that's in House Bill 4080 with the Dash 9. And the second component is relating to the changes made to the 529 accounts that you just alluded to at the federal level. So the changes made in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act at the federal level was allowing 529 accounts, funds would now be able to be withdrawn from those, not for higher education, but for K through 12 education as well. So there was discussion in front of this committee, both from the Treasurer and then also from Ledge Council, of some of the issues in front of the committee relating to the changes made at the federal level. What the Dash 9 does is it essentially requires an addition to Oregon taxable income for individuals that do withdraw those funds from the 529 account and use them for non-higher education purposes. So it's more or less in line with what the treasurer was discussing, where the 529 account here in Oregon would still be aimed, or at least the tax benefit would be aimed directly at the higher education. So it would stay more or less the same of what it is today. The change at the federal level, again, there are earnings on the account that those Oregon can't affect Oregon taxation, so that change remains the same federally on your federal taxes. But for Oregon, if you take those funds out, you would have an addition to your Oregon taxable income, and you'd also add back any of the interest earnings you have on your account as well. So it'd be related to the subtraction you took in previous years related to those funds that are now being withdrawn.
Very good. Are you okay with this one?
Which amendment are we?
The dash nine.
The dash nines.
That deals with this issue.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to offer courtesy to get this through.
Right.
But then revisit it when we hit the floor.
Thank you.
That would be all right.
That would be very helpful.
Okay.
Yeah. Colleagues, this is a relatively short, long amendment, but only because the sections of the code that are being amended is long. The amendment itself is very short.
Right.
And it's written as an exception to the deductibility, if I understand it correctly. The phrase that it modifies is, there shall be added to federal taxable income, colon. And then you go all the way down to K and you get this language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's an estimate?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, I would move the dash nine amendments to House Bill, I want to make sure I do this correctly, 4080.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves the dash nine amendments to House Bill 4080. Discussion? Yes, Representative Rushkin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this would be a fine approach if Oregon's public education system was the third best in the nation, but we're the third worst. And so I think taking away this tool for parents to get their children educated the way they want to in the best way possible is not the best path forward. So I'll be a no on the amendment.
Thank you. I'll simply note that failing to pass this bill puts the treasurer in a bind, because it is likely that somebody would sue over the violation of the Blaine Amendment, Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution. And that's the difficulty that we find ourselves in. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, Chairman Barnard, I mean, I'm going to respectfully push back a little bit, because right now, certainly people withdraw dollars from these 529 accounts to pay for tuition at religious institutions, for example, a Notre Dame or George Fox. So I don't understand how this would put the state at a constitutional risk.
I think you raised that during the hearing as well, if I remember right. Thank you. Other discussion? I think we need to call a roll. I'm sorry, Representative Marsh.
Oh, thank you, Chair. I would just point out we're actually not taking anything away. What we're doing is simply keeping Oregon practice in the same state it is now. Taxpayers will still be able to take the federal tax benefit that's offered to them if they spend these monies for secondary or elementary school. We're simply not changing our Oregon policy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think we better call the roll. The question is on the dash nine amendment.
Representative Bueller.
No.
Representative Findley.
No.
Representative Hernandez.
Aye.
Representative Marsh.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Representative Breschke.
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
I'm doing a courtesy yes.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Motion carries. We're on the bill. Do you want to move, or shall I ask?
No, I can move it.
Okay.
No problem. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 4080 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves House Bill 4080 to the floor as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? I think we better call the roll again. And again, now it's on the sending the bill to the floor.
Representative Bueller.
No.
Representative Findley.
Aye.
Representative Hernandez.
Aye.
Representative Marsh.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Representative Breschke.
Nay.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Motion carries, and with that, the bill goes to the floor. I will carry it unless somebody else wants to. I don't see anybody. Okay, Barnhart carries. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4080.
Representative Nosen likes to do that.
Thank you. Now I'd open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1523. You have the talking sheet. Okay. Yes. And how are we coming on the other pieces?
I think the amendment just arrived, so you should be good for 3 o'clock.
Okay. Before we go on, colleagues, can I inquire, do any of you have committees that will meet at 3 o'clock today?
Yes.
Okay, a couple of you do. All right. I'm working on the paperwork on 1529. Be prepared to come back later in the afternoon to talk about that bill. Right now we're on the hearing on Senate Bill 1523. So let's talk about that bill. Chris?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1523 pertains to the apportionment for interstate broadcasters. Back in 2014, there was a policy put in place that changed how these companies apportioned their revenues to Oregon. Prior to that, it was based on a share of audience.
Yeah.
And then in 2014, for tax years 2014 through 2016, it was based on the domicile of their customers. And that sunset, and it did not get extended in 2017. So what this bill does, it is renew or extends that program for 4 more years. It does make a couple of clarifications in law that align with how the companies were filing their tax returns for tax years 2014 through 2016. And there is also a piece that excludes Comcast, or it's interpreted to exclude Comcast from these provisions. Of course, Comcast isn't named in the bill. So within OLIS, you have the revenue impact statement and the fiscal impact statement, so I can go into a little detail there if you'd like.
Please.
The revenue impact statement is indeterminate, and I should also mention that in OLIS there is a interstate broadcasters report from LRO that was shared with the House Revenue Committee last session. On the issue, the legislature wanted that report drafted when this pilot program or temporary program was put into place to determine how well that worked. There was a lot of confusion or question about the revenue impact. The upshot of that report was unfortunately indeterminate because there was not agreement between the industry and the state as to kind of 3 main factors. 1, which companies are interstate broadcasters. 2, whether or not they have nexus or what triggers nexus, in other words, to what when they'd have to pay. And then 3, how much of their income would be subject to apportionment. So for those 3 factors, it was indeterminate, and at the time there were some audits undertaken by the Department of Revenue. And there right now there are about 4 cases that are either in the magistrate or at the Supreme Court where it's DOR versus the industry on those questions about nexus and which income is apportioned. And where that's relevant for the revenue impact is from, broadly speaking, from industry standpoint, their taxes are that they don't have nexus and they wouldn't owe any liability. So by changing to this domicile approach, they do owe liability, and then that's about a $1 million or so revenue gain to the state. From the state's perspective, however, it's the opposite. The Department of Revenue, through these audits, are making the argument that these taxpayers actually do have nexus and owe perhaps several million dollars in tax. It's a really unknown, and it depends on the court cases. There is some information around the court cases. So just since it's come across on the Senate side, I've been getting some of this information on the court piece, and it depends on the company and the year involved. But using very kind of round numbers, order of magnitude, the Department of Revenue is arguing that these taxpayers owe millions of dollars under that tax system. But this is the battle that's going on between the Department of Revenue and the industry. And for purposes of a law change, one of the foundations of making an estimate is clarity on the baseline tax. And so we have a situation here where there's disagreement about that baseline tax. So that's the reason for the indeterminate statement. I believe the fiscal was minimal or no. So that's kind of a high level of
where we are. Thank you. Any questions for Chris before we go to the hearing? Thank you. Let's call, it looks like Melissa Patrick and John Powell. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming on this bill today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. John Powell, representing the Motion Picture Association of America, and with me is Melissa Patak, who is Vice President and General Counsel of the Association. Mr. Chairman and members, a couple things that are, I thought you'd have access to the entire OLS circuitry, including the House side, so we did not submit Senator Burdick and Thompson's letter of support for that to come up, but just again for the record, Senator Burdick chaired the Senate committee in 2014 when the bill was passed that was referred to earlier, and her letter basically says she agrees with this extension of time for the program. Senator Thompson, who is chief sponsor of the bill, also submitted a letter of support, and Ms. Patak's testimony is on all us in front of you, I'm sure. So,
right, and we, in fact, we do have Senator Burdick's letter.
Okay.
I don't know that we have, I haven't gotten that far to
all
figure
right.
out whether we have the other.
Yeah.
But I think we have all the records
okay.
that came in the Senate committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll turn it over to Melissa Patak for her testimony on the bill.
Thank you. Thanks, Sean. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Patak. I'm with the Motion Picture Association of America. We are the trade association for the leading producers and distributors of motion pictures and TV programs. Our member companies include Disney, Fox, NBC Universal, Paramount, Sony Pictures, Warner Brothers, and CBS as an associate member. These companies and their affiliates own all of the major broadcast networks, CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, and the CW, and most all of the cable program networks that you'll know is everything from ESPN, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, Sci-Fi, Bravo, E, and everything Nickelodeon, everything in between. The broadcast cable program networks and the broadcasters and the cable program networks are known as interstate broadcasters. That's how they're referred to in the bill, and from this point on, that's what I will call them. We're here in support of SB 1523. The bill provides, as has already been said, an extension of time for the pilot program on apportionment of income for the interstate broadcasters. The 2014 bill, HB 4138, established an apportionment formula that taxed the interstate broadcasters on the income they earn from their direct customers, the Oregon-based companies who advertise on these networks and those who license their programming that they produce and distribute. This commercial domicile apportionment method recognizes the change in the broadcast business that has taken place in the last three decades. So, and now I'll just take a moment to talk about that history. And there are two charts. Right, let's look at this one first. So this explains how we got our TV programming from the sort of invention of TV until the mid-1990s. There were three major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And just to give you an illustration, on a Sunday night, you were either a Gunsmoke family, an Ed Sullivan family, or a Disney Wide World of Disney family. And those were the choices we all had. That was kind of uplinked to a satellite and downlinked to television stations, and then through microwaves, radio waves, it showed up on your TV in your family room, and everybody gathered around the one TV. Maybe some families had two TVs, but that's how you received your TV programs. so you know who the viewers are. So if you go forward to the next chart, you'll see that this industry has gotten very complicated, complex, providing everybody with a lot more range of choices and entertainment. So we have still have the broadcasters on the green column, the broadcast television networks. We have a couple of new ones, Fox and the CW should also be up there. On the top box, you have the newcomers, the cable program networks, and as I said, those just a handful, CNN, ESPN, MTV, and there are many, many scores more. And then below that, local TV stations. And then the very bottom is the newest form, which takes the programming and through subscription services directly to viewers, HBO Now and CBS All Access. They get it directly. But for all of the other program networks and the broadcasters, the viewer gets it through the middle column, the distributors, cable companies, cable operators, direct broadcast satellite operators, and telecommunications operators. And then there's also internet distributors. Everybody probably may have either a cable or a direct satellite subscription, and maybe you also have a Netflix subscription. And that's the way you get your programming. And the programming now also comes through the traditional television, but also now on your laptop, on your tablet, and even on your phone. So the programming is very mobile. It goes with the consumer. But as you can see, the relationship with the viewer is mediated by the distributor, and that's the customer. The viewer is the customer of the distributor, not of the broadcaster. And so we're trying to extend this taxing system that ensures that these companies, the interstate broadcasters, are taxed on their customers and not the customers of their customer. I know it sounds very confusing, but let me give you an analogy to tire manufacturing. Firestone manufactures tires. They sell those tires to GM and Chrysler and Ford Motor Company. Eventually, those tires get put on a car and get sent to dealerships and eventually to drivers who buy the car. But Firestone, the transaction between Firestone's customer is the car manufacturer, not the end user driver. This is a similar system that when we talk about commercial domicile, that's what we're referring to. It's very much like what was enacted last year, SB 28, market sourcing for virtually all other companies in Oregon. This would bring broadcasters into that framework. Commercial domicile has been adopted in a number of other states. Those states that followed Oregon in 2014 include Rhode Island, Tennessee, and Iowa. And there were other states that adopted before, Oregon, Michigan, Illinois, Texas, and Florida. And I know there's some concern from the Department of Revenue about the Multi-State Tax Commission, which is a uniform law group. There are a number of states of those that I listed that are all signatories and members of the Multi-State Tax Commission. Texas is a compact state. That's the highest level of membership. And they've adopted commercial domicile. So it doesn't – just because you are a Multi-State Tax Commission state doesn't mean you can't have commercial domicile. The other reason this system makes sense is it's very difficult to establish the viewing audience of these networks. Satellite companies and internet distributors just don't provide the information about who their viewers are to the distributors. And as I said before, viewers watch their programming in mobile ways. You're never sure where somebody is. Somebody comes into Oregon or leaves Oregon with their own programming subscriptions on their own computer. So the commercial domicile method gives stability and predictability and sort of gets rid of that uncertainty. It also is a question of fairness about taxing companies on the revenue they earn from their customers as opposed to their customers of their customers. So we would assert that, again, this legislation is extending the program that was enacted in 2014 for another few years. It will give the Department of Revenue and the LRO additional information about how it's actually working. Let me address, if I could, some of the confusion and the court cases and the audits. I know there is pending litigation, and there are pending audits. Much of the litigation is surrounds years that predate 2014. So I think that's an important factor to remember. We're looking forward here with this legislation. It doesn't mean that those issues may get resolved one way or the other. There's no certainty as to how the courts will rule or how the audits will come out. But we're looking at a way to go forward to ensure that the companies do file and recognize income that they earn in Oregon and pay a tax bill to the state of Oregon. And I think I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Let me start then. There's a bunch of amendments posted in our system. Are you supporting any of those amendments, or do you like the bill the way it's written?
We like the bill the way it's written. There was some discussion on the Senate side. The problem is one of timing now, and we're very comfortable with the way the bill is written. A couple of the amendments were the way the bill is drafted. In its current form, was drafted in a way to address some concerns that were raised last year about last year's version of the bill. So we are very comfortable with the bill in its current form.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add again, John Powell, I think given the proximity to sine die, an amended bill may not make it through the whole process because it would have to go out of this committee to be reprinted through the floor and then back to the other house. And I think it could well doom the bill.
I know that we have a number of other bills that are, if anything further, less far along in the process that we think are going to be approved. So I understand the point you're making, though. Let me, unless other people have questions, let me start on section two, bottom of page one, top of page two. Please forgive me for my ignorance about some of these issues, because I just simply don't understand what we're dealing with here. On line 24, we're removing the language, in the ratio that the interstate broadcaster's audience or subscribers located in this state bears to its audience of subscribers located both within and outside this state. Now, that's the old language,
right?
That you believe should not be applied anymore.
Correct.
All right. And the new language, I think I understand A and B, but I don't understand C. B basically, A says if you're an individual, you're a resident of the state, then you're counted. That's A. B says the customer has a physical presence in the state if it's a TV station or a cable provider. C says a commercial domicile of the customer is in this state in all other cases. Now, I'm not sure I understand what commercial domicile means in the case of a distributor. Could a distributor that distributes in Oregon be in New York and therefore not be covered here, and therefore they don't come under this system at all? Is that right?
Right. Let me just go, if I can just take a step back.
Yes,
before
please.
I answer the question. So this language, let me explain why this language was inserted, and it's different than last year's bill.
Yes.
We wanted to ensure that let me step back. So the customers of our customers, of our distributors, are advertisers and licensees. This section addresses licensees. One kind of licensee is a local TV station.
Right.
We were concerned that a local TV station might be here in Oregon, but might be part of a group of TV stations whose corporate presence was actually in another state. Okay. And we felt that because that local TV station was here, even if it was part of a group that was officially domiciled in another state, that we should recognize that transaction and have that revenue sourced to Oregon. So that's what this is about, okay? I know we gave that concept to Legislative Council, and I'd ask Legislative Revenue Office if there's something that I'm not explaining correctly, or if this language does anything less or more than what our intent was to ensure that a local TV station that licenses programming from one of our distributors, that is sourced to Oregon.
Now, so item C, the next one on line two of page two, the commercial domiciled customer is in this state and in all other cases. I assume we're meaning not talking about individuals, not talking about local TV stations, and not talking about local cable providers, but everybody else. And that would, I assume, mean the distributors. So the distributor's located in New York. It distributes to cable companies and other people in Oregon. Is it your view that that distributor has nexus in Oregon and therefore they would pay the tax here?
Well,
or something else?
We're the distributor. We are the broadcaster distributor. Those are our companies.
All right.
They license to a cable company,
right?
If that cable company is domiciled in Oregon, then that transaction, the license fee that is received in New York, but because that our customers here, then that would be sourced to Oregon.
Yeah, if they have a physical presence here, according to B.
Yes.
Right. Thank you. Okay, so that's where the issue arises, isn't it, between the current system, or the system that we had in place before the origin of this bill came in, and the system you're proposing now. Okay, let's go on. Are there other questions on this point? Not. Nope. So now you go on to say, the next piece simply has to do with income. The ratio that the interstate broadcaster's audience or subscribers located in the state bears to its total audience and subscribers located both within and without this state. I'm assuming that piece refers to the ratio that allows Oregon to tax at all.
No.
Let's hear from Chris so I get it right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is kind of a double amendment issue. Right. Because the program
sunsets,
this reverts to the old audience factor.
Right. After 2021,
thank
I
you.
Believe.
If you compare sections 2 and 3, you'll see the language between italicized and bold is reversed.
Thank you. This is the same problem I was having the other day on the marijuana bill.
Exactly.
All right. I appreciate that. I don't know why I'm having this difficulty, but because I haven't before, but I am now. All right. And that has to do with the Section 9, which describes when, wait a minute.
It's when the sun, yes. when it sunsets.
When
sunset.
The sunset, right.
So sunset. When it sunsets, if we don't have other legislation intervening, it would revert to the audience, the viewing audience
Thank
method.
You. Thank you very much. All of that makes sense. All right. So then you have some definitions in Section 5. Now, how did
Mr. Chairman, that's the Comcast
carve-out.
That's the Comcast
yes.
carve-out. Okay, why do we need a Comcast carve-out?
Well,
what's Section 5 do for us?
It means that they will not be subject to the commercial domicile apportionment, that their tax would be calculated differently. First of all, Comcast is the parent company of NBC Universal. That's the interstate broadcaster that MPAA includes, right? So Comcast is sort of a unique situation because they have a very large presence. They are a major cable provider here in Oregon. They happen to also own one of our member companies that's an interstate broadcaster. So they have tax liability on a range of income that they receive. And I know there's some litigation that involves them and some back years, and there was even a prior ownership of NBC Universal. It was owned by GE. It's quite complex.
That's an understatement.
Right. So because they're a major significant taxpayer, frankly, this viewing audience or commercial domicile on their broadcast operations, they said lay it aside, that it was not something that they felt that needed to apply to them, and so they were kind of willing to take themselves out of the coverage of this bill.
So it reduces complexity for Comcast without reducing their tax liability.
Right. I think that's probably a way to approach. Reduces the. It doesn't reduce. Yeah. To the extent this reduces anybody's tax liability, and that's a question we could we could discuss further, but
I think we will later. Right.
Comcast liability would not be affected by this legislation. In other words, they would not have the
either way with the Dash 5 or without it. I suspect it simply adds to pages to their tax bill, their tax return.
Right. I think it's simpler to say that they'd be paying under their NBCU parts of their business, NBC Universal part of their business, and they have Sci-Fi and a number of other cable networks that they would pay under audience, that part of their business, instead of not commercial domicile.
All right. Does anybody know whether they file this is probably a question that is not allowed, but I'm wondering whether they file a unitary income tax return. That may not be a question I can ask. I don't know.
Well, we have a unitary system.
Right. Okay. All right. I mean, they own cable companies here. Those produce income. They have a variety of other enterprises here. If they file a unitary tax return, then their income generated in Oregon is going to be taxed based on the ratios that already exist in the law without reference to this.
Yeah.
I think.
Do
you agree with that?
Yes, I think I agree with that.
Okay.
I'm not an expert on Comcast's corporate structure or their taxing.
I don't think anybody is, except people who are not allowed to talk about it.
Probably so.
Okay. Now, what does Section 6 mean?
So Section 6 was added in response to some concerns the Department of Revenue had raised. The Department of Revenue said that it seemed to them that there was not a hard and fast obligation of the companies to pay tax, that we were creating this commercial domicile method. They looked at it as, well, either you have nexus or you don't have nexus. And if you don't have nexus, then you don't owe tax liability. And this is a way to ensure, I mean, I'll say it the way our tax executives talk about it, to turn on the numerator, to ensure that that revenues received by these companies are attributable to Oregon, and that the companies have an obligation. And the DOR had also said that under the legislation that was passed in 2014, they weren't sure how to administer it, and so we inserted this language as an effort to give them some more certainty on to whom this applies, and a recognition on the part of our companies that it would be their obligation to step forward as taxpayers.
To use some shorthand that some of the committee members may recognize, this is the Joyce Finnegan issue.
Okay. No, here we go.
Right. Hi.
And a step further on the Joyce Finnegan issue, to build on the unitary concept. So, if there is a corporation that owns three other businesses, so you have four businesses involved, and Joyce and Finnegan are different methods to determine which of those companies have nexus in Oregon. And under the Joyce method, so we're talking about a unitary return with four companies. So under the Joyce method, each company has to have nexus on its own determination. The Department of Revenue has to go through companies A, B, C, and D individually and determine if they have nexus. And then if they have nexus, then their sales are included in the apportionment factor. Under the Finnegan method, DOR only has to assert that for one of those four companies. Finnegan is basically if one of you has nexus, then all of you have nexus. I don't know if that's the simplest way to describe it, but Finnegan is if one has it, everybody has it. Joyce is you have to go individually.
Now, has this been litigated at the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court?
There are some disagreements right now. Yeah, there's a case at the Supreme Court. I'm not sure how much it involves. But you're going to hear from DOR a little bit later.
The reason I asked the question is it strikes me that Section 6 might violate the Commerce Clause.
I think you're going to hear some concerns about that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the if indeed it did.
Which I think is the controversy around Finnegan, isn't
yeah,
it?
I don't know who would bring that that case unless it would get swept into a current Supreme Court case, because by the time this got to the Supreme Court, Oregon will be taking some kind of action, final action in this area, either go back to audience or go to the domicile methodology permanently. But the reason that language is in the bill is Representative Nose has worked tirelessly on this issue. And when I say that, we can both still get confused when it comes to it. But in our discussions with the Department of Revenue in the interim, they wrote to us, and they basically said, your companies, the interstate broadcasters, agreed to file according to Finnegan. However, and it's a quote, it says the department wanted to clarify that the Motion Picture Association projection of increased Oregon tax revenue was based on a Finnegan method, which is prohibited by statute. That's why we put it in the bill.
Now, then to go on.
And if
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yes.
Interject one other thing. Yes, the Commerce Clause constitutional violation was raised with us. I mean, again, we put this in. It was not in last year's bill. It was not in the original bill that was enacted in 2014. But we put it in to satisfy this issue that DOR raised. If it's unconstitutional somewhere down, there is a standard severability clause within the Oregon statute. Mm-hmm. And I have that site somewhere, maybe yeah. when DOR is testifying.
174.
I'm familiar with that.
Okay,
yes.
So the rest of the statute could get saved if this part was somehow deemed unconstitutional. So we did think about that issue too, but it was put in to address this concern. So
thank you. And finally, for me at least, there may be other questions, but for me, I'm looking at Section 9. It appears that there is a sunset on Section 5, January 1, 2021, Section 6 doesn't appear to have a sunset. So in Section 9, I'm looking at line 8,
that's correct.
Page 3. So if I understand the way we do our bill writing, Section 6 would stay in the law if this bill passes, unless it was repealed or amended.
That's correct.
And then it shows that the other changes. Wait, maybe I'm wrong.
No.
Section 8.
That would.
Section 8 may actually save it.
Right.
Because it sub 3 says that the amendments to a statute by Section 8 apply to tax years beginning on or after. Okay, so that is the
audience.
Go back to the old rule.
The audience viewing audience.
It
right.
doesn't deal with Section 6, however. Section 6 appears that if we adopt this bill, Section 6 becomes permanent. Have I missed that somehow?
I don't think you have. I think that's accurate.
So we would be taking an irrevocable step unless the legislature acts again
right.
to change from Joyce to Finnegan for this purpose.
So for broadcasters, but I also. We're doing this as a pilot program.
It's not a pilot, though, if you've made it permanent.
Well, but the commercial domicile is a pilot program. Because that part sunsets. The commercial domicile part, which actually is the apportionment formula that would apply to broadcasters, that sunsets. And I think I can speak with some degree of confidence that MPA would present itself back in a couple of years to see how that the apportionment method is working, to see if there's better data, more data, and we would be back in the legislature with extending it further or making it permanent or addressing the issue in some other way.
Thank you. Other questions? I realize I've gone into great detail on this bill, but this is one of those bills that we worked pretty hard a few years ago, and there have been significant changes since then that I simply did not understand. I really appreciate the clarifications.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
if I might just end by saying you know, none of us know what the Supreme Court's going to decide in the cases that are in front of it. The current case that I watched oral arguments on recently was argued in January. Those involved the 2007, 8, and 9 tax years, well before this started. None of us know how that case will turn out and future cases. So to know exactly what the revenue impact is, as Chris pointed out, we can't tell you because a lot of it will depend on the outcome of that case or those cases. So we just, when people want to talk about the revenue, if we could just stand up in front of you and say here and here, that would be simple. We can't do that because mm-hmm. that's in flux. And my guess is the court did seem very interested getting back to the tire example that Melissa gave you as to why theme park revenue in the state of Florida is in the numerator of taxpayers in Oregon. And they seem to be puzzled by that. I don't know if the case will hinge on something like that, but they were indeed puzzled. I think the association is equally puzzled and would like certainty. They want to be taxpayers and they want to be good citizens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When do we expect the Supreme Court's going to rule? Do you have any
Mr. thoughts? Chairman, I don't know. Assuming a January argument, maybe late spring or summer sometime.
And so why do we need to do this bill now rather than waiting till 19 when we have the answer?
Mr. Chairman, there are other issues that I think this answers, including what the domicile system actually produces in terms of revenue. And when this passed in 14, there really have been a very few years of filings simply because some companies file on a calendar year, some on a fiscal year basis. So from 14 to 17 sounds like 3 years, but it's actually less than that in tax years. And this bill will give us that additional.
Let me try again. Let's suppose that this bill does not go forward and that instead a bill like this is approved in 19. What do we gain or lose by waiting for the court's decision?
I'll try to answer
please.
That. So you gain a lot of uncertainty. The Department of Revenue will come forward and say, well, if we don't have commercial domicile, then all of these companies are on viewing audience. So you'll have them auditing the companies, and the companies will look at each one of their programming networks, and they'll look at the audience for ESPN, and that will be one audience. And the audience for the Weather Channel will be a different audience. The audience for Fox News will be a different audience from, obviously, the audience from MSNBC.
Right.
There will be challenges, right. And it will be complex, to say the least.
So what is the challenge? What is the Supreme Court deciding now? I thought that the issue before the Supreme Court was to deal precisely with this question.
No, it's
have
not.
Have I missed it?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I haven't read the case in its entirety. They're dealing with who is an interstate broadcaster in a complex company with many affiliates and subsidiaries, with all sorts of streams of income from theme park to TV to cable revenues. Who is a broadcaster? Who is an interstate broadcaster? And what methodology applies? Is the whole company a broadcaster? Or do these different revenue streams have different taxing rates? That's at least part of what the case is about. So, and again, it's for years, back years. I think the Supreme Court case covers 2007 to 2009. And it's about one company. And the other companies that are members of the MPAA, I'm not sure they're necessarily bound by a court case over particular facts that apply to a particular company. So waiting for this court case, I don't think is going to lend any more clarity or clear the path for action.
Thank you. You finally provoked another member of the committee.
Notes. I'm going to go at the 1,000-foot level,
please,
Mr. Chair, which is, I think at one level, I am concerned about would we generate more tax revenue under one system or another. And in listening to this exchange, you know, I care a lot about that, but it also seems like it's uncertain, and no matter what, and it's going to be litigated. So you can't predict, okay? So then, faced with that, then you go, okay, this is the direction of taxation that we are going for everything else in our state. And maybe it doesn't generate as much revenue as we think it should, or under the old system. But we will have certainty, and it's clear, and we won't be in court, all right? And so maybe that's a reason to embrace it, especially when you look at, we're doing this style of taxation for everything else in this state. We're not, and so, you know, I sort of struggle. I'm a sponsor on this bill, all right? You know, and I am a, you know, with a Southeast Portland, you know, liberal who would love to have more money for schools and other government services, okay? But I also want a tax system that is rational, that we can implement, you know, and it makes sense. And so, you know, I think I continue to fall on the side of doing the pilot, but I get a little nervous every once in a while about it.
Good. Thank you. Yeah, and of course, the point that I made is that Section 6 appears to be permanent in this bill rather than just a pilot. There was someone else over here who wanted in. No. I think we'll let you off the hook
for now.
Thank you so much.
Go on with the rest of our testimony. Thank you so much for the thorough explanation. John Calhoun, Jody Weiser, please. Anyone else want to be heard on this bill today other than the department? Okay. Good afternoon.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. So, you know, our look is way above this. There's nothing in the bill that says you'll have more information 4 years later. They're not being required to answer any questions. The Department of Revenue asked 26 companies questions, and most of them didn't even answer. And there's no teeth to getting answers from anybody. So you're 4 years farther down the line. But where's the pilot? Usually a pilot actually allows you to say, here's the change, and here's the consequence of that change. There's some kind of test of worth. And there really isn't any test of worth. It's just a four-year extension of the same law. And so if we really need a little more information, then why is it a four-year extension rather than a one-year extension? And why isn't required reporting with penalties if you don't respond part of the legislation? The department, according to the report that LRO put out, the department asked 26 companies to respond to a question, to a set of questions. 15 of them didn't respond at all, and 2 of them responded and said, we're not broadcasters. Well, that doesn't, if you get that kind of a response rate, is it because they didn't notice the letter that came in and asked for a question, or is it that the people who it was the best advantage to not answer, best financial advantage to not answer, is who didn't answer? And so this is extending a way of taxing, but it's not a pilot. A pilot would actually ask for what are the consequences of this, and we don't see how you would get any consequences out of the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Calhoun.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith, Warner, Vice Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is John Calhoun. I'm basically echoing what Jody said. We don't have the data. We're not hearing what the revenue impact is, and you know, we've got the Supreme Court case coming up. Why not have a one-year extension and revisit this next year when you have the information you need and require the industry to provide the information so you know the revenue impact, the concerns that mentioned. It seems like we're rushing through to extend for 4 years for something where you don't know why you're what the implications are of passing this legislation for 4 years. Thank you.
It right now, many companies will have started filling out their 2017 taxes. What if you said fill them out both ways? No, some of them will start 11 months from now filling out their taxes because it depends on their tax year. But if you said fill out your taxes both ways, then you would have a way of seeing what the consequences are.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much, the department. Mr. Anderson. Oh, and both of you. Good.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Henderson, the Department of Revenue. Just wanted to speak to the record on a couple points. The department did submit meeting materials that kind of provided an outline of our research that we've done, what other states, how other states handle this. And so just to kind of speak to maybe some of the testimony that there's this trend away from an audience or subscriber ratio to a commercial domicile approach. This document on the screen here just shows that it looks like there are seven states that have followed here to a commercial domicile approach, and it looks like three of those states, Louisiana, Michigan, and Illinois, kind of have a hybrid. So they don't even have a true just straight commercial domicile. It's more of a hybrid. Parts of their receipts are sourced under an audience or subscriber ratio, and parts under commercial domicile. And again, just to back up, the department is absolutely neutral to the policy, can administer either apportionment method for broadcasters, but just wanted to speak to a couple of things. The commercial trend being one, and then also, I guess, the comment that a commercial domicile approach is more reflective, more consistent with market-based sourcing, which is adopted by Oregon in its 17th session, Senate Bill 28. Adopted, shifted away from a cost performance sourcing to market base for corporations. That's one opinion, that it's more reflective of a market. But however, the model that Oregon adopted in Senate Bill 28 was language taken from the Multi-State Tax Commission, the MTC. The MTC promulgated model regulations, market-based regulations, in February of 17. And those regulations call for receipts from broadcasting, either from advertising or content, to be sourced to where the location of the customer's customer is. So when it comes to the Multi-State Tax Commission and their model regs, which Oregon adopted as of January 1st, it identifies the market for these receipts to be the location of the subscriber or the audience. That's the market for these sales. So just wanted to clarify that.
Okay, and good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, also with Department of Revenue, and I just wanted to talk about some of the technical concerns we have with the language in the bill as it's currently introduced. On page one, lines 27 and 28, we have some concerns with the statement, and we did share this with the MPAA folks as well as Representative Barnhart's office. The customer is a resident of this state. We would look to our standard statutes on residency, and you had a bill just a little bit ago about the factors that we look at in determining residency. I'm not sure how these folks would have that information about a customer, whether they're a resident of the state or not. So we would suggest that it would have a billing address for that their customer. They would have that. I think that would be a necessary amendment. That is not something I think that these companies would have access to in the case of individuals. Also, we had concern about the customer, the local television customer, having a physical presence in the state. I think that we had asked for some language there, and they had agreed to some changes in that sense as well. On page two.
Excuse me, is that in an amendment somewhere that we already have?
Well, I thought that we had a note from your office to work on that, but I don't see any amendments on that, so
okay.
I'm not entirely sure.
We may have slipped up. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Okay. In Section 5 on page 2, colloquially called the Comcast carve-out, there's some definitions that we aren't sure what they mean, in particular in line 23, an internet protocols television service is undefined, as is the direct broadcast satellite television service, so we'd like some clarity on what those provisions mean. And then finally, in Section 6, we have some concerns that I think Melissa Patak alluded to, the constitutionality of potentially the information that's in line 36 and line 37. This is the shift from Joyce to Finnegan for these folks only, not for all taxpayers. Again, the department, you may remember last session, we had a concept that brought forward Joyce to Finnegan and for all taxpayers. So we would shift from one to the next for everyone, not just one particular industry. So that does concern us slightly. However, more concerning in this is the fact that this provision says that they would have to put this information in their sales factor without regard to whether they have a taxable presence in the state. And that is the part. Finnegan, at least one of them has to have a taxable presence in the state in order to be required to be in the return. And so we would suggest language that says that the in determining the sales factor for a unitary group filing a consolidated federal return, the numerator of the Oregon sales factor shall include gross receipts determined under ORS 314-684-4 if the interstate broadcaster or any unitary member of the interstate broadcaster's consolidated federal return is taxable by Oregon. So that would be more of a true Finnegan provision if you chose to go down that path.
Okay. Any other items you want to raise? And then we'll go to questions. Yes, Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. Deanna, thank you for your comments. On the Comcast carve-out, I was wondering whether there was any possibility of that carve-out applying to others as well as to Comcast. And if we don't know what internet protocol television service or direct broadcast satellite television service specifically means, is that a possibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, we have the same questions you do.
Other questions? The last panel raised the issue of gathering information that would allow this to be a real pilot. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that issue a little bit? How would you go about determining in 21 or whatever year it would be, what would you be saying to the committee in that legislature, and what information would you have available that you could share?
Mr. Chair.
Without the additional information from the companies that the last panel asked about.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we put this into place in 2014, we added a checkbox on the return and asked for a schedule of information for them to provide information as if they had calculated it under the audience factor, audience method, as well as under the commercial domicile method, so we could back in and do the report that was required in the original 4138, I believe it was, in 2014. That information, I think Jody Weiser mentioned, was not provided. I think it was in the report that Chris provided. So we had very limited information from those schedules to be able to provide the information. What we will have in 2021, though, is we would have more tax return information filed, assuming that it's included with the return. The information, right now we have 2014 and 2015 returns because these corporate tax filers take so long to file. They're on a fiscal year, most of them, and most of them file very complex returns that are filed on extensions. So it's typically about 2 years from the due date of the return before we have access to sanitized information that we can share and base reports upon. So by the time 2017 tax returns, I think that's the final year of this one, right? 14, 15, 16. And then it'll be a couple more years before all three of the pilot years are available for you to have information upon, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Yeah. Should we be asking for additional information in a bill like this to allow you to provide us with not us, but the legislature in 2021, adequate information that would allow them to make decisions about this topic? And if so, what would that additional information look like?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd have to give that some thought. I think that that there is no consequence for not providing the information because we don't have access to their books and records. So if you've created some sort of a consequence, but I don't know, other than requiring them to calculate it both ways to show us the difference, like we did in our schedule, I don't know what else you could do.
Well, that was of course proposed by the last panel, I think, to calculate both ways. Okay. And you say we don't have the amendment that you were asking about. I mean, the things that you've raised seem of great concern to me around the definition section. We get into all kinds of trouble in this committee when we don't define things well, as the vote this morning on the floor, I think, describes pretty clearly.
I only saw the dash five online.
The dash six is on there now, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry?
The dash six is on
there. Oh, it is on here? What does the dash six do? Maybe Chris can answer that.
The dash six is basically just section one of the main bill. It just moves the sunset date out to 2021. It doesn't make any of the other changes.
I was just going to say, the dash six doesn't address the questions you just asked.
But of course, if those sections are gone, then you don't need definitions for them.
That would be correct, Mr. Chair, yeah. Yes.
What would be the effect of the adoption of the dash six on the issues that you raise?
Mr. Chair, if only section one of this bill remains, then we would continue the pilot as it was originally enacted in 2014. It wouldn't make any of these changes. It wouldn't move us from Joyce to Finnegan. It wouldn't have the Comcast carve out. It would just be a straight extension from 2017 to 2021.
Okay, now from the standpoint of a study, continuing the same study that you started several years ago gives you additional data, additional years of data on based on the same idea. Does that make a difference in terms of your ability to reach conclusions,
Mr. Chair,
in a report?
I believe that the original bill had a reporting requirement by LRO, which I believe they have fulfilled. I don't believe that there's another reporting requirement subsequent to this.
So in other words,
we would need
not only the dash six in order to have a consistent set of years that extend out into the future, but in addition to that, we'd need to renew the report requirement.
I believe that is correct. I think it was a one-time report. I'm going to pull up the original bill right now.
We could always. We work for the committee.
We don't have to order LRO in a law. We can tell them to do it, and they will smile and do it. Right.
Yes, and they will do that in consultation with us, as usual.
Yes, as usual.
Which was the original report. It was required not later than February 1st of 2017, but it was just one time.
Thank you. That's pretty clear. All right. Any other questions for this panel? You can see this thing gets pretty complicated pretty fast. Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. Anything else for the public hearing on 1523? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 1523 and stand at ease for about 2 minutes. I want to consult on where we are on the other matters that may be coming before the committee today. Stand at ease, please.
Okay, so where are we? We have the dash A4.
Well, okay. You know, with these policies.
The committee will come back to order.
It is.
Colleagues, we're going to need to meet again this afternoon. The speaker has given me strict orders that we're to deal with this bill today. We have a new amendment, which I haven't had a chance to review yet, neither of you, the dash 14 amendment, that I would like to review. And we also don't have a fiscal or revenue estimate on this bill. When can we meet again? The House is meeting at 3:30. Several of you have committee meetings at 3 o'clock. I'm going to propose that we schedule for 4:15 and then recognize that we may, in fact, meet after that based on when the floor gets out of session this afternoon.
If you say 4:30, we'll give an hour for the floor.
All right. Representative Smith-Warner suggests 4:30 rather than 4:15. I don't know whether this is going to take a lot of time or not, but it does give members a chance to review the amendment. And would you describe what this amendment? While we're open, let's open the work session. Now that I'm no longer dealing with scheduling, let's open the work session on House Bill 15. Is it 1529? And would you describe, if you can, what this amendment does as compared with the bill that we received from the Senate?
We're talking the A14?
I'm sorry, the A14. Yeah, this is the new amendment based on the negotiations that we've been having with the Senate Finance and Revenue Chair and our own leadership. Would you tell us what this does that's different from that?
This is the amendment that's come in, why we've been in committee today.
Yes, it did. Yes.
So the dash A14, I haven't had a chance to look at it in detail, but
well, let's go through it. We have time right now. Let's just go through it, and okay, and you can review it and discuss it while we do that.
So lines 3 through 9 make a technical reference change to the Internal Revenue Code. This relating to the repatriation. This is the core problem where we had the quirk in Oregon 14. Law. Okay, that didn't you. Require the add back of the federal dividend received deduction.
Would you tell us why that's important or why it might be important?
The add back of that?
No, this change.
Right, this change is important because the drafted bill referenced Internal Revenue Code 965, which is where these dividends are supposed to show up. But we could find ourselves back in that same spot if the IRS decides somehow, and we're not sure how that would happen, that those would land in a different part of the IRC. So this is just broader language referring to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, saying broadly, the repatriation dollars in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act are what get added back. So okay, it's a broad reference to that federal legislation as opposed to a specific IRC reference. We just okay, didn't want to
so
make
it's a technical fix.
We didn't want to come back and make the same mistake again.
So this is a true technical fix.
Correct. It's just how it gets referenced. So then on lines 10 through 14 is a substantive policy change. And rather than having the repatriation dollars go to the rainy day fund, they are going to the public employees, the PERS fund that's being set up in Senate Bill 1566. And that idea is this is one-time money, so it's being redirected to that PERS fund that's being worked out in 1566 instead of the rainy day fund.
And that's lines?
Lines 10 through 14.
10 through 14. And the lines 7 through 9 are a part of that or part of the thing before?
Part of the thing before. Lines 3 through 9
okay,
are that reference. All right. It pops up in two places.
And what's lines 1 and 2? Do you know what that is?
That's also part of that reference.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So lines 1 through 9 have to do with getting the reference correct so we don't get into the box that we're in right now around the repatriation dollars.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, all of ones, lines 1 through 9.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
10 through 14 to PERS instead of rainy day.
Yep.
Line 15, I believe, is the language that deletes the tax haven law. So, and I'd have to, I don't have the bill in front of me, but I think that's what that does.
You better look.
So
yeah, go ahead and describe 37. And
okay. Section 37, which is lines 16 through 21 on this page and line 1 of the next, requires the Department of Revenue to produce a report and provide it to the Legislative Assembly on the relative efficacy of the tax haven law, which is ORS 317.716, the listed jurisdictions, as compared to the new federal policy known as GILTI. And on line 1, it's the Global Intangible Low Taxed Income. That's the GILTI that makes up GILTI. So the idea there is that the GILTI provisions are effectively getting at the same notion as the tax haven law, that the feds are stepping up and doing that. And so that's the reason or the argument for the repeal of the tax haven law is that with a federal provision under GILTI, you don't need the tax haven law. So Section 37 would require DOR to write a report on comparing those two policies, and the report would be due December of 2020.
Okay. Is that going to produce a fiscal?
That's one of the questions that are out to right now.
I think I just asked for testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I have to say that my agency just sent a fiscal impact response over to the Legislative Fiscal Office. I have not read the assumptions, but it is a small fiscal. It looks like about $36,000. I don't know what how LFO will weigh in on that once it's produced.
All right. Well, that's another reason for us waiting to work the bill until we've gotten the information on it.
Presumably, most of the cost has to do with the reporting requirement, but I'll look at that as soon as I get a chance to review it.
Thank you.
And I have a correction to what I said before.
Please.
On the one page, line 15, where it says on page 27, delete right. lines 4 and 5.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the applicability.
Thank you. I was trying to figure out where you were at. I was
right. And actually, it just simply moved it from one section number to a different section number when you right. when so you add the lot page, the material on lines 2 through 4 on the next page.
Sometimes Ledge Council changes the section number. In this case, they deleted it and then added it in the bold on okay. lines 2 and 3, yeah. 2 through 4 on the following
yeah.
page.
Yeah. So in other words, it's still there. They just changed the section number. Yeah. yeah. Okay. All right. Well, any questions for Chris now, recognizing we're going to have to come back when we've got the paperwork? Representative Marsh, please, and then Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. This may be a question for Department of Revenue. I'm just wondering if that December 1, 2020 date is going to be time for us to accumulate an adequate amount of data to actually do these comparisons. That'd be probably 2 tax years.
Well, actually, we're talking about tax year 17.
Well, 17's different. I mean, it's special in its own way because it's not business as usual in 17.
I think you're going to hear that's probably just 1 year, maybe 2018.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, DMA, Department of Revenue, and to answer your question, we should have 2017 information for sure, and we should, more likely than not, we'll have 2018 information by November of 2019, I believe, but we'll have some information for 2018, but we'll have all of 2017 for people who have filed returns.
Okay, but 2017, we have the whole repatriation happening.
Correct.
So that's a different.
Right. So in 2017, we should have we should have 2017 returns in-house by the end of 2019, full year, and by the end of 2019, we'll have part of 2018 return data available. So we won't have both years complete. So January 1 of 2020 might be an issue.
Right. December 1st
of 2020. I'm sorry. Then there should be time.
So you think
about a month or so, yeah, that we could probably do some finessing. I'd have to look at that and talk with my research folks and my corp folks to make sure.
And of course, if there's a problem producing useful information, the 2019 or 2020 legislature could move the date.
For the due date of the report.
For the due date of the report, which is the end of the year.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is so important. I want to make sure that everyone, including myself, understands this. So if we go back to the dash A14s and we go to line 15, where it deletes line 4 and 5 on page 27 and then inserts section 37. If we go to page 27, we delete 4 and 5, which reads section 37, which effectively is when this act takes effect, deletes that out. It then inserts the new section 37, which effectively just says the Department of Revenue shall report back to the Legislative Assembly regarding the efficacy of the provisions. In no way does this, and this is where I want to make sure I'm very careful on this, in no way does this delete the tax haven.
Correct.
Well, I apologize.
I just wanted to double down on that.
No, the original bill does that.
Correct.
The original bill deletes the tax haven law.
Okay.
Isn't that right?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, that's the bill we got from the Senate. And that we're not making, this amendment makes no changes in that provision.
That is correct.
Does it?
Correct.
Okay.
This is a reporting piece.
Correct.
Right.
In section 37.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And let me just say that the part of the rationale for asking for a report, in effect, what we're doing is instead of saying the legislature must act in order to repeal tax havens in 2021, we're saying instead, if this report comes in and it says tilt, guilty doesn't work, we need to go back to tax havens. At that point, the legislature would have to affirmatively reenact it in order to bring it back into effect. And that's it's a difference between an opt-in and an opt-out. I think you understand that, yeah. And of course, it's much less likely to get an opt-in at that point,
right,
just because the legislature has to act in order to do it. That I think that was the rationale, was simply changing an opt-out to an opt-in.
Yep, thank you.
Anything else right now, while we are open right now? Okay, I'm going to... Representative Bueller, did you have something? Yeah. Yes, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I'm just a little confused how the fiscal could be so small.
It's just for the report.
Oh. Okay. Not for the whole.
Not for the, no.
But let me.
But yeah. even on that.
Please. Yeah.
So we're taking the, we're transferring the amount that is produced, and it goes to offset a liability as opposed to going into an asset, which would be the rainy day fund.
Correct.
So to me, that seems like we're spending it in this A14, but in other, we are actually going into essentially a savings account.
In the original bill,
right.
I think that's an accurate.
So how I think could that's it an be only state. A $36,000 fiscal?
Right? I'm sorry. The fiscal only has to do that we asked about. Only has to do with the preparation of the report. It doesn't have to do with where the money in the...
It doesn't have to do with the whole amendment?
It doesn't have to do with the whole amendment, no. What she was talking about, do you want to come in and explain, rather than having me try to do it, explain to Representative Bueller what the $36,000 estimate is?
Right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And Representative Bueller, the fiscal impact we have doesn't... moving a distribution from one fund to another fund is very easy for us to do, and it doesn't cost a lot of money for us to move money from one account to the other. You may be talking about a revenue impact, and I don't know what the revenue impact is associated with the changes from that bill and where it would be funded from the rainy day fund to the PERS account.
So your reference is just what it costs the agency itself.
The fiscal impact is just what it costs our agency to administer that bill as amended by the A14. And so mostly it's that report.
Does that answer your question?
It does.
Representative Bueller, thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out to this committee again, this is the Ways and Means person in me. Once again, we're putting another responsibility on the Department of Revenue for them to do additional work. You have to understand it. Well, and the Representative Marsh gets this. In Ways and Means, we keep pounding on Department of Revenue for all this additional requests they keep bringing to us. We need to remember we're the ones funneling that to them. So I would share this just as an aside. Dan, I would expect that we're going to ask you to report to Ways and Means on all the additional responsibilities that have been placed on the department.
I think I heard you say that in Ways and Means the other
just
day.
Know that's coming.
So thank you.
There'll be an additional expense for that.
We
report.
Want to know the bill. Yeah.
We will get a list. Yeah. There's a lot of them.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Just keeps adding up.
I've learned that it's valuable to have a Ways and Means member on this committee to keep reminding us of the of our nefarious ways. All right. Anything else right now? In that case, we're going to recess the work session on House Bill 1529. I expect to reopen it when we reconvene at 4:30. And with that, so we'll close that. We will recess that work session now, and committee, we are in recess until 4:30. Have I got it?
Yep.
Okay. All right. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, it turns out that Senate Bill 1529 will not be ready to work today. We are holding it over until tomorrow. When we will consider it along with the other business that's already scheduled. And with that, the committee is adjourned.